Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Listening to Hollywood Time Machine with Alicia Mayer, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Hollywood Time Machine, your vehicle to classic film, the golden age of television and old-time radio. This is your host, Alicia Mayer. I'm in Sydney, Australia, and of course I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Will McKinley, in New York City. Hello, Will, are you there?
Hello, Alicia. I'm here. How are you?
I am well, but I understand you and everybody else who's very likely to get to TCM FF 2015 have some exciting news. Tell me what's up.
Yes, the big news this week was the 6th annual TCM Classic Film Festival was announced, so everybody can stop standing in front of their computers 24 hours a day.
Yes.
Not that anybody has done that who's involved in this conversation currently, but...
No, of course not.
Of course not. So the dates are March 26th through 29th, which is actually a good bit earlier than usual. In fact, it's a month earlier than the latest date for the festival, which was in 2011, 2 weeks earlier than last year. But it's exciting. We're glad to hear that they're actually doing it, because for some of us, there have been some questions with layoffs and buyouts announced at Turner and some concern about the future of Turner Broadcasting and of, you know, TCM in particular. So are you planning on being there this year?
I am planning on being there next year, Will. It is very important to me that I get there and finally meet the gang and hang out and really enjoy being immersed in something that really is got to be Mecca for all of us. I understand that the theme is also a little bit controversial. Do you want to share that with us?
Well, you know, I mean, the theme of the festivals to me is always secondary. They could just say, you know, we're going to show you a bunch of movies and you're going to love them. And I would, you know.
And you would.
And I would. I mean, I've been there every year for 5 years and I'll keep going as long as they do it. But the theme this year is history according to Hollywood. And they're promising to explore how cinema has shaped how we view and remember history, and selections are expected to focus on works about the past that are a reflection of the period in which they were made, and also how Hollywood has reshaped facts to create tales that are not always true to the historical record. Like,
never.
That ever happens.
Never. My goodness. What on earth?
Yeah. So there's, you know, I mean, these themes are broad enough that, you know, that they could show many, many different films. And of course, there's already speculation that's begun of what those films will be. But the other piece of news is that the prices have gone up, unfortunately, but not by much, only $50 each for each pass level.
Mm-hmm.
The spotlight pass for the rich people is $1,649. That's $1,649. So
right.
save your pennies for that. The essential pass is $749 this year. The classic pass is $599, and the discount pass is the palace pass for $299, and that gets you into all the screenings at what used to be called Grauman's Chinese Theater and the Egyptian, and that's a really good option for people who can't otherwise afford the more expensive passes but would like to be part of it. They also discontinued the matinee pass, which was a pass that got folks into screenings during the day, which was a good option, again, for people that were on a budget.
What about the pass, the one where you stand across the street and you just cry and watch people in long lines? How much is that one?
I think that's free, although you have to have dollar bills in your pocket to pay off the costumed superheroes that wander up and down Hollywood Boulevard. And if you come next year, be prepared for guys in dirty Spider-Man costumes to hit you up for cash.
No, that's not going to happen. Now, Will, I understand that you have an insider's guide to the festival on your blog, and people can have a look at that and get some inside info at willmckinley.com. I had a quick look, and I am excited, and I do plan on being there. And I understand that there's a certain level of involvement that also involves a press pass. Can you just quickly explain what the press pass would mean for those people who are bloggers out there?
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about the world of classic film is that, you know, there are a lot of fans who are active in their engagement, you know, with this fandom, as opposed to passive. And they have blogs, they have, like, you know, podcasts or online radio shows. And if what they write about and what they report on is related to what TCM is interested in, they can get a press pass, which gets it's basically like a free classic pass that gets them into everything but the opening red carpet screening, and all of the events at Club TCM and the talks and the panels. And, you know, the expectation on the part of TCM is that folks will tweet about it and write about it in the days and weeks leading up to the festival, and then report on it during, and then write about it afterwards.
Which is, of course, what they want to do.
Right, and it's TCM is smart enough to know that their best press and their most engaged press comes from the fan bloggers, more so than the mainstream press. So they are very, very good about honoring the work of the fans and the bloggers and, you know, people who work really hard to, you know, to get the word out.
Fantastic. Now, tell us about our fantastic guest, Will.
So we've got a great show this week. We have animation historian Tommy Stathis, who will talk about TCM's Night of Rare early animation, which is happening this Monday. We also have Profiles in History CEO Joe Maddalena, who will discuss how his childhood love for old movies led him to found the world's largest auction house specializing in Hollywood memorabilia.
And, you know, we're just four shows in, and already some nepotism has crept into the Hollywood Time Machine, Will. We'll be chatting with my cousin, Tony Shepard, who will remember his father, Richard Shepard, 1924 to 2014. He passed away earlier this year. He was the producer of the iconic Breakfast at Tiffany's, and I don't think there's a single soul who follows classic film who wouldn't know about that one.
Exactly, and we're also going to be giving away lots of prizes this week and taking your phone calls, which is always an adventure.
That's right. What we want to hear from our callers today is really how did this whole madness, this insanity of being crazy about classic films start for you? And Will calls this, listeners, the origin story. So we'd like to hear from you. What is your origin story?
Right, and real quick, Alicia, what is yours? How did you get into classic film besides your family name?
Well, I actually got into it pretty much from classic literature. My stepfather used to read to me a lot of Dickens novels, and I remember particularly David Copperfield. And perhaps maybe just one day I stumbled across the old David Copperfield, the MGM production, and fell in love with it that way. But I do also remember my grandmother pulling out a whole bunch of black and white prints that showed her with the stars of the day, because she was a photoplay columnist. So there were a number of different influences, Will. But what about yourself? How did this happen?
Well, I mean, for me, it's really attributable to my father. My father was in his early 40s when he and my mom adopted me. And, you know, so he shared with me the films that he had grown up watching as a kid, you know, growing up in the Depression era. And that was, you know, classic comedies like the Marx Brothers, Abbott and Costello, The Three Stooges, Laurel and Hardy, and also the Universal horror films. And it all sort of grew from there.
Absolutely perfect, and I can just see you, a tiny Will, sitting in front of the TV, just like I was a tiny Alicia sitting in front of the TV all those years ago, but probably really just about 15 years ago, right, Will?
Exactly, exactly. So everybody have your stories ready, and we'll get to them at the end of the show, and should we go on to our first guest?
Let's do that.
Great. Our first guest is an animation historian. He's based in Queens, New York. And on Monday, this coming Monday, October 6th, he'll be appearing on Turner Classic Movies with host Robert Osborne as part of Back to the Drawing Board, an evening dedicated to the earliest days of theatrical animation. Tommy Stathis, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Oh, that's terrific, Tommy. So we're talking about our origin stories. I don't know if you heard Will's and mine. How did you first discover that the very rare early silent animated films that you'll be presenting, how did you discover that they were of interest to you?
Hello?
Hello.
Go right ahead, Tommy. Just keep going.
Okay. Well, as any child, I think, would, I loved cartoons, and I also had a knack for understanding and appreciating history. So at a certain point, as a 5 or 6 or 7 year old, I began reading about the history of animation, and I began to wonder, well, where are these films that were the first ones made, and where can I find them? And I found that there were so few of them out there on home video that I started researching ways to find old film prints and that sort of thing.
And you were about 6 years old when this hit you, I suppose. So you were very young.
Very, very young, yes.
And then after that, you discovered Mice and Magic, Leonard Maltin's classic, yes?
Right. That was the first really major book focusing on animation history that reached a lot of people. And Leonard Maltin's animation history research in the 70s really laid the groundwork for many historians that came after him. And that was a book that I came across as a child in the 90s.
To establish for the audience, you are how old?
I'm 25 now.
So you were really, you became a fan of classic film in the home video era. Were you able to see these early films on home video?
There were a few of them out there. There were a few of the basics, like, you know, Gertie the Dinosaur and some Felix the Cat and things like that. But I would say there were only, you know, a couple dozen cartoons out there from the silent era that anyone could buy and watch at home. So there was a very limited viewing experience in that sense at that time.
So did that mean that at a certain point you were actually seeking out and collecting physical film prints, like 16mm film prints?
Yeah, that came about, I would say, when I was a preteen, late 90s, early 2000s, and that was that happened for two reasons. I came across, or I should say I was exposed to, 16mm film technology through some older relatives, and I also found out from other people who were interested in this field of study that was the only way to really see a lot of these films. That was to find old film prints that were struck, you know, in the 50s and earlier that did not make it to home video.
Right. Now, you'll be on Monday, you'll be presenting 10 shorts from the Bray Animation Studio. Who was John Randolph Bray, and why is he significant in animation history?
Well, he started out as a cartoonist. He was born in 1879, so he goes way back. He started out experimenting with animation in the early teens, and he'd seen films by Winsor McCay and James Stewart Blackton, and he figured that he could turn this into a business. And what he did was he went around and he learned about animation techniques that were out there and patented them as his own, in addition to developing some of his own techniques. And he's called the Henry Ford of animation because he was the first person to really form a successful studio and use the assembly line method of production for cartoons. So he was getting distribution contracts with studios like Pathé and Paramount, and he was the first one to really produce cartoons regularly and on a tight schedule so theaters could show them regularly.
And you're going to be sharing this on air with Robert Osborne. And I wonder, Tommy, if I could just ask you to speak up a bit because the line is a bit light. You're going to be on air with Robert Osborne this Monday, and that must just be an absolute dream come true. So how did you go with that? Were you nervous, concerned at all? How did it go?
I was pretty nervous.
Not surprised.
I'm not completely sure it happened still. I have to see it on the TV to really make it gel. But it was a great experience, and Robert's a very warm gentleman, and all the wonderful things I've heard about him on and off screen are really true. So I was really grateful to him for that.
Now, Tommy, you're going to show 10 shorts on Monday. Did Bray have recurring characters that, you know, that folks, that viewers at the time were interested in and sought out?
I would say so. Bray was also the first one to have a recurring cartoon character that was created just for movies, and that was Colonel He's a Liar. But other people who came to work for Bray created characters like Bobby Bumps, and Max Fleischer came along with Coco the Clown, and then there was Walter Lance with Dinky Doodle, and these are all people who became much more famous later on with their own studios and their own later characters. But there was a whole slew of characters and series that came out of Bray that people were familiar with and sought out on a regular basis back then.
So for the classic film fans that aren't necessarily familiar with this very early stuff, there's a direct line from what Bray did to maybe the better-known stuff like Betty Boop and Popeye, you know, from the Fleischers, and even eventually characters like Woody Woodpecker from Walter Lance, right?
Absolutely. It was Bray who gave the people who created those characters their first start. And without him, I think the animation industry would not have formed the way it did, or it would have formed later somehow. So he, you know, people who love classic animation, that you know, characters like Betty Boop and Bugs Bunny and that sort of thing, they owe a lot to Bray for kind of laying the groundwork for that.
And then, as with all TCM viewers, you know, we're interested in the studio era, but we're also interested in what preceded it and what followed it. So this is an important, you know, this is an important piece of knowledge for folks to learn about. So we encourage everybody to tune in on Monday night to see Tommy with the great and powerful Robert Osborne. Well, Tommy, thanks so much for being on the show. Back to the Drawing Board starts Monday at 8 p.m. on TCM, and the salute to the 100th anniversary of Bray Studios starts at 9:45 p.m. Eastern. And you can connect with Tommy on Facebook and at TommyJose.com. And Tommy Stathis, thank you so much for being with us tonight, and we'll see you on TCM Monday night.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Our next guest is the founder and CEO of the world's largest auction house specializing in Hollywood memorabilia. He was also the star of Hollywood Treasure on Sci-Fi, and he joins us today from Los Angeles. Joe Maddalena, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, how are you?
We are great, and we're thrilled to speak with you.
Hey, Joe.
This
is Will McKinley in New York, Joe, and we're talking tonight about our origin stories, how we first discovered classic films. So how did you catch the old movie bug?
Well, I always tell this story to my 21-year-old son, that when I was in the olden days, before they had this thing called the internet and VHS, us old folks had to watch television conventionally on CBS, ABC, and NBC. I lived on the East Coast, so we had the privilege of having this fuzzy thing called UHF that came from Boston on Channel 56. So the only way to watch movies was once a year when they would come on. So the tradition in my family was The Wizard of Oz would come on during the holidays, and we would be glued to the TV set, and I would wait a year for it to see it again. So during that time period, I was just engrossed with this world of the magic of filmmaking. I grew up on the East Coast, so my avenue, my venue, was basically reading about it. And when I was 12 or 13, I kind of got the inclination that I wanted to get more involved in the getting to meet the stars, you know. So back then, it was very easy to pick up the phone books at the public libraries. I used to pick up the phone and call Margaret Hamilton. At the time, she was forward doing, you know, coffee commercials, but she was the Wicked Witch. And I became friends over the years with Ray Bulger and Jack Haley. And when I went to college in Malibu, Pepperdine, I was friends with Larry and got that both. They were both at the Motion Picture Retirement Home. And at that time, these people had been forgotten about. Like, this is like the mid-70s to like early 80s. So I started writing articles about these people's lives for a publication that was came out of Florida called Big Reel. And I interviewed Ginger Rogers and Buster Crabbe and just everybody. So you were a teenage classic film blogger
before such a thing existed.
Absolutely. And my thing was just basically to tell their stories and say, who was Buster Crabbe? How did he get to Hollywood? How did he become Flash Gordon? How did this happen? You know, and just be in telling their stories because they had been forgotten about at that time. Even Clayton
You're
Moore,
right.
You know,
the resurgence really hadn't happened,
about.
Had it? And the resurgence
had
really hadn't happened. So I understand that you were raised around antiques much in the same way that I was, but the difference for you was that your family were actually antique dealers. Is that right?
Yeah, so my parents were antique dealers. I grew up on the East Coast, and it was incredibly boring for a little kid to look at pottery and Oriental rugs and, you know, Chippendale furniture, and, you know, you can imagine what a 10-year-old would think of that stuff. So I gravitated towards paper. So what was the natural thing were, you know, books. So I started reading The Maltese Falcon, and, you know, I started reading Casablanca, and I started to realize that most of our great movies were written by our great novelists, Faulkner and Hemingway and Steinbeck and Fitzgerald, and I just went on this journey of exploration, and the real connection for me was I then realized, like, these authors, like Dashiell Hammett, who wrote The Maltese Falcon, he didn't write the screenplay for the movie, and I just couldn't understand that. So I started collecting scripts and trying to understand the process of Hollywood. So I approached this in a very different way, and then I made it into a business.
Now, so how did Profiles in History begin? Because a lot of people are fans, but they don't necessarily turn it into a life or a career.
Okay, so I was a television production broadcasting major. I had the privilege of going to Pepperdine University, which is one of the top, you know, schools in the country. When I got out, I was an intern for Vince Scully. I was making about $900 a month, and I was living on ramen soup, and I was renting a room in a house in Malibu the size of a closet. And I suddenly realized that this probably is not going to be the career for me. So I reverted back to my origins, and at the time, Hollywood had a shortage of East Coast furniture, and the East Coast had an abundance of East Coast furniture, so I would had my parents ship containers out to California, and I would sell their wares for them, and I would make myself 20 or 30%, and in 1983, I started to do this full-time, and by 85, I opened my company. I sold, and I still to this very day, I sell rare books and manuscripts. That's how I got started.
So, and how do you acquire the items now that you are offering at auction? So, for instance, we've got this massive auction coming up, which we'll speak about shortly, but how do they come to you now?
Well, it's connections. I mean, I work with a lot of the studios, so one of the auctions we have right now is with New Millennium. We have Expendables 3, we have Hercules, we have Conan. I did the Captain America auction for Marvel Entertainment. I did the Lost auction of all six series of Lost for ABC. So I work with a tremendous amount of filmmakers. In this auction, Jonathan Frakes from Star Trek was selling his collection. This auction, Robert Weiss was selling his collection. So, you know, basically who's who of Hollywood comes to us at one time or another, either to buy or sell.
Now, Joe, I know a lot of fans assume that classic film memorabilia is going to be extremely expensive and it's going to be out of their price range. Is that always the case, or does the opportunity exist for fans on a budget to participate in an auction like you guys offer?
Well, our field is still very, very new. If you have a rare coin or a stamp or a baseball card or a comic book, by now you pretty much know that what they're worth. Our world is still pretty esoteric. There are a lot of things that you can still buy for a few $100s or a few $1,000s. And I know a few $1,000s might be a lot of money, but when you go into the collectibles world in general, a few $1,000s is not very much money at all. So you can still buy something wonderful for a very small amount of money. And then if you compare it to, like, anything else, we're selling Orson Welles' signature jacket from Citizen Kane from the podium scene. We're standing in front of the podium with a big portrait of Citizen Kane in the background. That's one of the most famous images in the history of Hollywood. We're selling that jacket. It was discovered at Western Costume. The estimate is $60,000 to $80,000. Why isn't it worth $1 million? You look at what the contemporary art sells for, and you look at the importance of that coat. It doesn't make any sense. So people,
and tell us about some of the other items as well, Joe. I understand you've got Peter Fonda's Captain America chopper. What are some of the other signature items that people will just be drooling over?
We have the Easy Rider motorcycle that was used in Easy Rider, written by Peter Fonda. One of the coolest things, I think, is we have Leonardo DiCaprio's jacket from Titanic. It was only one jacket. The customer, it's a 1940s jacket, and basically its jacket is where he yells, "I'm king of the world." So we have, and only used one because it was a rental. We have things from The Lord of the Rings. We have Gandalf's staff. We have a ring wave. We have, things from Star Wars, Star Trek. We have an Indiana Jones whip that was donated by Steven Spielberg that we're selling. Hugh Jackman, of all people, was selling his complete Wolverine costume that came directly from him, that from Wolverine, from the second X-Men movie, head to toe with the claws. I mean, that's an iconic item.
And you also have the Scarlett O'Hara costume from Gone with the Wind, correct?
We have a Scarlett O'Hara costume from Gone with the Wind. We have Rhett Butler costume sketches from Gone with the Wind. We have three Munchkin costumes from The Wizard of Oz.
Right now, with the Munchkin costumes, that kind of brings you full circle, right, from when you were a little kid sitting on the floor watching Wizard of Oz on TV.
Yeah, I am by far the biggest Wizard of Oz lunatic on the planet. I've had the privilege of selling three pairs of ruby slippers. 2 years ago, Mr. DiCaprio was kind enough to buy a pair of ruby slippers for me and donated to the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, and I facilitated that transaction. So, yeah, I mean, I handle more Wizard of Oz material than any person alive.
And do you need to be in the L.A. area to participate, Joe? If you've got, if you've hit up your spinster aunt for a whole bunch of money, how can you take part in the auction?
Yeah, you can. The wonderful thing about the internet is you can bid anywhere in the world. Like in Australia, for example, we probably have 300 or 400 customers, and we have customers
really?
In 150. Yeah, we have customers in 150 countries. You can just go online and you can bid just like you're in. It's like you're sitting at our auction. It's something you can. First of all, you can go to our website, profilesofindustry.com. You can download the catalog free of charge. There's 800 pages that you can look at. There's photographs, costume sketches, set design, costumes, vehicles, everything. So, decide on what you like. You can watch the auction live time, and if you decide you want to buy something, you can bid, and we help you with shipping and handling and all those things, and everything is guaranteed authentic. It's a fun collectible. It really is. If there's some movie that moves you and you want a piece of that, memory, that's what you're buying is a memory.
That's great.
An amazing collectible.
And for the fans like me who don't necessarily have a spinster aunt who's funneling cash to them, lots of great pictures, original photos that are in the, $100, $200 range. So we definitely encourage... We definitely encourage all the listeners to check that out. Casey, our intern, will be tweeting the link on our Twitter if she hasn't done it already. And Joe, thank you so much for being with us. So, folks, Hollywood Auction 65 is October 17th through 19th at Profiles in History and online at profilesinhistory.com. And you can follow them on Twitter at PIH Auctions. Joe, thanks again for being with us.
You're welcome. Have a great time. Take care.
Thank you, Joe. And while we're waiting for Tony to join us, I was having a think about the Mork suit. So Robin Williams' suit is also going to be auctioned online. And so it really speaks to how almost emotional some of these items can be.
Yeah, I mean, I've been at a few auctions, and it's really hard not to get caught up in the moment, because this stuff is, as Joe said, I mean, it's part of American popular cultural history, and to have a piece of it in your possession is kind of cool. Even if it's a small piece, you know. It's-
Will, I'm just going to interrupt you and see if Tony has joined us now. Tony, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Oh, hi, Tony. Thank you so much. Our next guest is the manager of broadcast marketing and a producer at Walt Disney Parks and Resorts, and he's also a cousin of mine. Welcome to the Hollywood Time Machine, Tony Shepherd.
Thanks. Glad to be with you guys.
Oh, thank you. We are talking tonight about classic film origin stories. I think that you would have to have one of the biggest. You know, you grew up really in the business. Can you just give us a quick rundown of the family members and your connection to it all?
I'm fourth generation in the entertainment business. My great-grandfather, who's your great-uncle, was Louis B. Mayer, who had two daughters, one of whom married David O. Selznick, his daughter Irene. Irene's sister Edie married my grandfather, William Getz, who ran a couple of studios. He ran Fox. He also ran Universal International. They had two daughters. One was my mother, and my mother married a guy at the time who was a talent scout for Columbia when they got married, but went on to produce a bunch of movies and was a talent agent and literally was in the business until the day he died in January of this year.
Wow. And you're talking, of course, about Richard Shepherd.
Yep.
And yes. And tell us a little bit about his career, and then we'd love to move on to your career as well.
Well, you know, as I say, my dad, he really had a heck of a career. He started off working at Columbia Pictures as a talent scout. He worked for Lou Wasserman at MCA. He was a junior agent there, and then moved across the table to become a producer and produced a number of films with the late Marty Jarreau, the most famous of which is Breakfast at Tiffany's, which actually premiered. I think it was 61. I think it was either October 3rd or 4th, so it's actually the anniversary, 43 years, whatever the number is. He made a number of other movies, none nearly as famous. The Fugitive Clown with Marlon Brando, The Hanging Tree with George Peppard, a really truly terrible movie called Love in a Goldfish Bowl with Adrian. not a great movie. He was an agent. He, Freddie Fields, and David Beagleman started the company that is now International Creative Management, ICM. And then did a little bit more producing later in his life. He gave Tom Hanks his first role in a feature film of a movie called Volunteers. Or actually, second role.
Right.
After Splash.
Oh, yes, I remember Volunteers. A friend of mine was also in that.
Interestingly, kind of bookended Audrey's career, because he made Audrey's last movie, which was Robin and Marion, which she co-starred with Sean Connery in. As I mentioned, really the last 35 years of his life, he represented, you know, writers and directors, which I think was really his passion. That's really kind of what I think was really his thing.
Now, Tony, folks, of course, know Breakfast at Tiffany's, and they are, you know, classic film fans are familiar with Robin and Marion as well, but Audrey Hepburn had taken a long break from filmmaking before Robin and Marion. Did it take a lot of convincing on your dad's part to get her back in front of the camera?
I think it did. I think it's a movie that she loved because, you know, she was very fond of my family. She was very fond of Sean. They knew each other very well socially. And saw a certain irony in the fact of playing, you know, Maid Marian many, many, many years after, you know, one would kind of know, you know, think of the quote traditional story of Robin Hood. You know, the thing that some people know, a lot of people don't know, is Audrey could have acted every day of her life from the day she made Tiffany's till the day she passed away. She gave her entire life. That was her passion.
And I understand that not only, you know, was your father pulled into the film business, but also that he was heavily involved as an agent for some of the most famous in the film business during the time. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, my dad looked after at various times in their career everybody from Marilyn Monroe and Frank Sinatra and Barbra Streisand, people like Lindsay Lohan. I mean, it really spanned the gamut. I was actually talking about it with my girlfriend just a couple of days ago. She said that she had seen Parent Trap. And I said, which, of course, my question, having grown up in the business, was, which one? And she said the Lindsay Lohan one. And I said, yeah, my dad looked after her. He actually made that deal. And that's, frankly, most of my memories of my really young childhood growing up with my father was him working with those people. I remember vividly, when you run a studio, and my father ran two of them, he ran both Warner Brothers and MGM, one of the perks is they give you a screening room in your house. This was in the 70s and the 80s. It's not like it is today. I mean, I have a theater in my house because, you know, things are different now, but in those days, these things actually ran film. I mean, they had the same big old screen projectors that you find at the theater down the street. So I remember as a child sitting in the kitchen, and I heard a voice saying, is this the San Clemente White House? Joking, I looked up, and standing in my kitchen was Paul Newman. He was looking for the screening room, and he couldn't find the front door of the house.
Wow. Goodness gracious.
Because my dad was his agent for years.
Now, Tony, you started your career in television, right, and worked on many iconic TV shows of the 70s, like Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy, Taxi, Charlie's Angels, right?
Yeah, I was head of current series casting for ABC back in the late 70s. That was my first job at television. Having come out of the theater, that's kind of where I started. It was really the iconic days of TV. That was the days that ABC was the number one network, and virtually every comedy that was on the air, they had every single one of those hits. And in fact, again, it's kind of come to the surface, over the last few months, because I would certainly not call Robin Williams a close friend, or probably not even a friend, but he was certainly an acquaintance, somebody that I saw sometime over the years, because I used to cover those tapings. I used to go to those work every Friday night. I would go from the work committee to the Bosom Buddy tapings, which was a show that I was had a significant hand in, just because both Tom Hanks and Donna Dixon came out of the new talent program that we all worked on when I was at ABC.
Tony, it's just, it's really TV nirvana for many of us, and I think we all wish that we were a fly in the wall. I don't know if you can hear that the connection is a bit bad, and it sounds a little bit like you're broadcasting from the middle of a solar storm on the sun. So forgive me, but there's so much more to talk to about, and I'm wondering whether or not we can speak with you again so that we can perhaps have a better line. But I want to thank you, Tony. Yes, that was wonderful, and as your cousin, it was great to hear your voice. We haven't met yet, so we'll have to do that at some point very soon when I'm next in America. Yes, and you can share some stories with me and a glass of wine. So, Tony, thank you so much. Wonderful to speak with you, and a great pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
So that was the afterburners from the time machine, apparently, that
we were definitely entering the atmosphere there, and I feel terrible too, because Tony's stories are legion and legend, and it's a pity that I'm sure many of our listeners found that a little bit difficult. But I hope that you hung on for the ride, folks, because that was great. And now, Will, tell us, where are we in what's next now that we're all recovering?
Well, so we've been talking about the classic film origin stories all night, and now it's time to hear from the listeners.
Yes.
So how did you discover classic film? Was it a parent? Was it a grandparent? An aunt? Uncle? How old were you? When did it happen? We want to hear your story. So here's the way this is going to work. First, when you call up, make sure to turn down your speakers. Second, tell us your first name and where you're calling from. And third, keep it nice and short so we can hear from as many people as possible. And if you get a busy signal, just hang up and call back. And if when you call, the call is picked up and you don't hear anybody, that means you're online to be our next caller. And we have lots of great prizes tonight. We'll start by giving away the revised 75th anniversary edition of the Gone with the Wind trivia book, The Movie and More by Pauline Bartel, which is a great book. So call this number, folks. Here's the number, 1-818-602-4929. And we will take the first caller, and you will get the complete Gone with the Wind trivia book.
While we're waiting for that first caller, I was thinking about what Tony was saying, you know, that there were all of these people that you know, and you may have not known them as a friend, but of course they were an acquaintance. They were people that you could say hello to. And I think that's how the film colony has always been.
We've got a caller.
Fantastic. Let's go.
Hi. What's your name?
Hello, caller.
Hi. My name is Kate, and I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina in the USA.
Hey, Kate, what's your classic film origin story?
I really enjoyed listening to you. I was actually reminded that the first classic film I saw was The Keystone Cops with Abbott and Costello, and I think it was Max Sennett that did it. And that was actually, we had the old movie projector. And when you were talking about watching home movies and how you could see those at home, we did the one, we showed our home movies on it, but the one movie that my parents did purchase was that movie. And that was my first, the first one that I saw. And of course, my mom, who told us that her father's cousin was Laura LaPlante, and she loved old movies. Laura LaPlante was from the 20s and 30s, silent film, and the 30s.
Wonderful.
And
you mentioned Keystone Cops, I just had to laugh because we all remember just how madcap that was. And I think you could probably draw a straight line from Keystone Cops to sort of the madcap and zany comedies that we remember from the 70s and 80s. I want to thank you so much for calling. And if you could please make contact with us on our Facebook page, which I hope you've seen, and we will get to you about your wonderful prize. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Sure enjoyed your show. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Wonderful.
And our next caller is?
Kelly Pratt, calling from Lawrence, Kansas.
Kelly Pratt! Woohoo! For folks who may be on Twitter, Kelly Pratt is Irish Jayhawk what?
6'6".
Irish Jayhawk 66 on Twitter. And so Kelly is a familiar face at the TCM Classic Film Festival and on TCM Party and Twitter. So what was your first classic film memory, Kelly?
I think it really came from my grandmother. And I remember she is probably the main reason why we have this feisty love for our Irish heritage. And, of course, introduced me to Maureen O'Hara. And The Quiet Man was kind of our Bible of our family history, sort of.
Right. So the Irish angle, I had never thought about that.
But she also said, I remember the very first film we watched together, she said, you have to see this film, it's important. And it was Witness for the Prosecution. So
right.
That was my first entry and, you know, just went on from there.
Now, Kelly, I mean, a lot of us, you know, or a lot of people maybe will watch a film and it doesn't necessarily take hold. What is it about classic film that kind of resonated for you when you were little and became such an important part of your life?
Well, you know, I think the main thing that she and my Uncle Patrick really introduced me to was comedy, and comedy remains my favorite genre. And I think comedies is something that, you know, I had, you know, some interesting childhood experiences, some rough times like many people do. And it really got me through anything that I was having a bad day or bad experience. Comedy has always kept me smiling and shining, and, you know, it's the best. And that Marx Brothers reference that you referred to, Will, is my favorite sense as well.
Exactly. I mean, for me, you know, I find, and I've talked to a lot of people online about this, that the comedy is a great route to discovering classic film, because funny is funny, whatever it looks like, whether it's black and white or color, whenever it was made, funny is funny, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for calling, and you will be the proud winner of the 1-year subscription to John Wiley's The Scarlet Letter, or Gone with the Wind newsletter. What do you think, huh?
All right. Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it.
Excellent. All right. So we'll say goodbye to Kelly, and we'll take our next caller. Next caller, where you're calling from, and what is your name?
Hi, this is Denise from the Gold Coast in Australia.
Oh, we have
an
Australian caller.
Oh, my gosh, Denise. Hello. How are you?
Hello, my darling. I'm good. The show is fantastic. I'm loving it, every bit of it.
Oh, that is so great. So, Denise, let's hear your story. How did this? How did you get the bug? How did it bite you?
My bug was from my grandmother, my nan, and every Saturday we used to have the midday matinee movie, because of course, yes, I come from that era too. We had to watch TV shows, the movies on TV, not on DVD or VCR or whatever it was. So, and one of my strongest memories was Ezekiel Farley. That was, to me, just the most amazing movie.
Now, I've noticed this a lot, Alicia, that... for a lot of folks, classic film is sort of like a family heirloom that's passed down from generation to generation. You know, our parents loved it, or our grandparents loved it, and they shared it with us. And in some cases, if those folks are no longer with us, this is kind of a connection to them. Denise, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I can't tell you the amount of different films when they come on that bring to my memory my grandmother and watching them. And another one was The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau with Tony Randall.
Like, yep.
I love the movie magic, and the whole beauty of being transported somewhere different when you're a little kid was just amazing to me. So.
Now,
and
Denise,
I can remember my mom taking me to see Gone with the Wind and telling me that it was a long movie and I'd have to sit and be still, and I did for the whole movie, and I was absolutely in awe and in love with Clark Gable at probably 7 years old.
So, Denise, you are a native of Australia?
Yes, I am.
So was the access to American classic film any different for an Australian maybe than it was for folks here in the United States?
Probably, I'd say the same with the classics. It was, you know, it was weekends, Saturdays and Sundays. If it wasn't sport on TV, the other station shows classic movies, be them comedies or dramas or whatever they may be, but you had back-to-back movies from midday till about, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon before the news. So that was our time.
I have to laugh at that, Denise, because when I first came to Australia, you basically had, on Saturdays, two choices. You had sport or you had sport, but occasionally you also had classic Hollywood. We're very near the end of the show, Denise, so I want to thank you so much for calling.
Can I tell Denise what she's going to get? So, Denise, you're going to get... Denise, you're going to get Vivian Leigh, An Intimate Portrait by Kendra Bean from Running Press.
Oh, wonderful.
Which is appropriate, right,
appropriate
for a lifelong Gone with the Wind fan like yourself.
Absolutely,
and I do love my bios. I absolutely love my bios. So thank you very much.
Excellent.
Thank you, Denise.
Thanks, Denise.
Well, we did it, Will. I don't know, do we have swag left that we didn't give away?
We do. We have one great piece of swag. It's the print catalog from the Hollywood Auction 65 from Profiles in History, which is a big
prize. Okay, well, let's find some fantastic way of giving that away, maybe via Twitter or Facebook. So people, stand by for that. We're getting very close to the end of the show, and I want to thank everyone for listening and for bearing with us on maybe the sound quality of one of the calls, but also just having fun with the origin story. Will, thank you again for being my co-host. What have you got to say to me, friend?
Well, folks, we encourage you to connect with us online at aliciamayershow.com on the web. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. You can follow Time Machine Talk at Real Alicia Mayer and at Will McKinley. And we'd love to chat with you on Twitter and Facebook and online.
And just quickly, I'm going to say thank you very much to Gary Sweeney for tearing down our old website and putting up the Taj Mahal of Classic Hollywood websites. Thank you, Gary, and thank you to Casey, our fantastic intern, who is running her butt off right now. Thanks to everybody, and let's do this again next week. Hey, Will, what do you reckon?
I definitely reckon, and make sure that people... can I say that because I'm American?
You can't say it because you're not Australian, so don't even try.
Right. Well, great being with you, Alicia, and we'll see everybody again next week on Hollywood Time Machine.
You're listening to Hollywood Time Machine with Alicia Mayer, right here on LA Talk Radio.